And we'll be joining Ben's comments already in progress. We unfortunately lost the very beginning of the panel, but I think you'll be able to follow the gist once Ben kicks in.
Alternative versions, graphic novel versions of fandom stories, which I think the Wide Vision is part of that evolution too. And he wanted to do this one in Wide Vision too, and me like an idiot, I pitched back at him the idea of doing it as the first Chronicle. I mean, something I don't think we've ever seen before. I've worked with the Scandinavian publisher Egmont and seen stuff in Australia, and I don't think anyone's ever done it before. So I was like, let's go out on a limb here, see what we can do, and tell a prose story with art that's actually drawn in the hand of the first family. And Pat Quaid, my co-conspirator on some of the early Phantom stories, was game for it, and next thing we know, here it is. And obviously they brought in Art Line to do the coloring and the design, and that's it's got a whole other life of itself.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. I initially had no idea how to do this, and I just started experimenting. I did the. I'm trying to think back now. It's been a while, but the paper textures and the script, the handwriting script and the coloring, that was all mine. And I was a bear. I was a bear just trying to make it look. One of my goals was trying to make it look as if it was done by an amateur, kind of, because his job wasn't writing or drawing or coloring. So I was trying to make it look a little bit sloppy, a little bit not quite professional, which is a really odd thing because I'm a professional, so I had to figure out, okay, how do I make this look good, but at the same time, not look quite right?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's, when it's someone's handwritten journal, and granted, it's a journal written by someone 500 years ago who was doing it because he finds himself in a situation in his life where, he was prepared for this. He was the son of a sailor. He was never going to be shipwrecked on an island and become, the guardian of the Eastern Dark. I mean, he was supposed to, become a captain of a ship someday, and look at what happens. So when he had these events happen to him, realized, okay, I need to chronicle, the story of my life. And I think the fact that you gave it that sort of rougher around the edges, when appropriate, there's the page, the ink splotches here and there, and the water stains and stuff. It shows that it's almost like a living document, which is a really, a unique take on it.
Thanks. Yeah, that was my goal. I wanted to have a bit of a raw, kind of, almost unfinished quality to it. As if it was written over the course of who knows how long.
Okay, let's see.
Sorry about that.
So yeah, I mean, that's pretty much the genesis of that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anything else to add off the top of my head?
Thank you. We can turn this over to Paul here to talk about this incredible artwork. Perhaps some secrets of how this was done.
Well, this is all this artwork is photo-based. I start with photography. Everything you see, it was real at some point before I got my hands on it. It's not too dissimilar to rotoscoping in film. There's a film coming out with Keanu Reeves called Scanner Darkly. And I'm not up on my film releases. And it's a similar technique where you take, in the film's case, where you took live-action footage and then draw over it. In this case, it's still photography, which is drawn over. And I even have a little cute term for it. I call it paintography. TM. And
you better hop on that, get that trademark.
That's right. So in some cases, it's a little bit difficult to get a hold of certain things that you would need for such a project as this. And that's where things like photo archives come in handy. Like, for instance, in this particular example, the hut that you see behind the guy drumming is a stock photo. The jungle you see behind the top image is a park near my house that I added that I superimposed with a few ferns and whatnot to give it a more tropical look. The guy he's throwing through the air is a 12-inch action figure. But the person throwing him, the Phantom, is yours truly. That's I use myself as the Phantom. Well, you see, that's the beauty of being an illustrator, is even though I don't have that body, I can draw one on myself, actually. That's how that works. So my wife got to take pictures of me in a swimsuit for that. It was quite entertaining. And then And then some of the Photoshop work here is a little bit obvious with certain filters, like blur filters, as you can see there, or the top image has the background as a radial blur to create that sort of sense of motion. And and same thing with the bottom panel there. And yeah, it is a little bit hard to describe all the techniques that go into it, but essentially, for instance, on this left side, for those elements, it's myself with the, so that's, I'm just wearing swim trunks. Then I change my skin tone. I buff myself off. Then I change the skin tone, add mask. I actually had prop 45s for that. The holster is a miniature holster. I didn't have a 45 holster, so that holster is about 3 or 4 inches tall. The idols behind them are sort of those Pier 1 sort of things that you can get that are about 10 inches high, these little clay pot things that you can buy and put on, you know, for $20 and put on your shelf and pretend like that you're a cultured fellow. The ring was a souvenir ring that they released when they did the Billy Zane film.
I have one of them.
So I figured, hey, I have a phantom ring, why not use it? And then the flames, I have a fireplace, so I just made a fire and took a bunch of pictures of fire and chose the right one. A lot of the work comes in selecting the stills, because I'm not, especially if I'm the model, it's up to my wife to take a bunch of pictures and then I have to plow through them and say, oh, okay, this didn't quite work, move to the left, move to the right, that kind of thing. So once I take the picture and composite the any miniature elements or background elements, I then create a separate layer and start painting and drawing using a stylus and tablet and to get the effect I need. And until you see what you see here. And I highly recommend looking into Photoshop. It is a tremendous tool. And the thing is I'm kind of a Luddite. I mean, as slick as this may look, I know very little about computers. And if it weren't for point and click and drag and drop, I would be nowhere.
So you put very little effort into this. Thank you, Paul.
No, I'm talking about the wonders of the GUI interface system and the intuitive nature of the Photoshop software. I mean, obviously you need illustration skills, but what I'm saying is that for illustrators out there, budding illustrators, don't be intimidated by this tool. This is going to be the way to illustrate in the 21st century. And in fact, I didn't even start working on computers or even dealing with Photoshop until the year 2000. It took that sort of odometer, clicking over from 1999 to 2000, and I realized, okay, I've got to step up. Like, more and more clients were asking me to deliver my work on disk, which was something that was, at that point, was beyond me, so I had to learn to do that, and then I started playing with Photoshop. And it was almost like a computer game for me. I just said, what does this do? What does that do? I was just playing with it and practicing with it. But after 8 hours, I had more to show than just a high score. So especially for younger kids out here who may be intimidated by just the process of drawing itself, oh, I'm not very good. Well, you know, it's the old adage, practice makes perfect. If you just realize that you're not gonna, you know, be great at first, that if you just work at it and practice at it, ultimately, that the effort that you put into it, the time that you invest, will pay off.
I would not be here if it weren't for Photoshop. So,
well, I don't think I would have gotten that Eisner nod if it weren't for Photoshop. So I'm going to have to thank Sethium Narayanan, or whoever that fellow is, when you first call up Photoshop. You have a list of people. That's my favorite.
Tier 1?
That's it. Tier 1. Exactly.
Thank you, Paul. Mike, would you like to tell people what maybe is coming up here on the ongoing series?
Okay, well, my first issue is issue 12, but that's both covers up there. The one on the left is done by Joe Prado. He's doing a lot of DC work right now. Just finished some Birds of Prey up. He's got a couple other books coming out through DC. Joe and I have been friends for years, so when we came time to get a new cover artist for kind of a new look, nothing against Doug because he did some great covers, but we wanted to kind of make sure that, you know, when you see issue 12, you know it's a whole new direction, whole new everything. So we grabbed up Joe, figuring that he could deliver some real good stuff, and I think he did. I think that cover's awesome. On the right-hand side, that cover is an alternate cover done by Ruben Procopio, who is an ex-Disney animator, and he's now doing a lot of sculpts and so forth. There's a new Samurai Heaven and Earth statue coming out that he did. He did the new Electric Tiki Phantom statue and a couple others. He's also doing some of the artwork in the upcoming Phantom Annual. When you look at the two covers, they were both kind of iconic images, but they also both have the tigers in it. The story Tiger's Blood is basically an introduction of an all-new Phantom villain that will play a really key role in all my issues. Kind of planning out to issue 25, where I'm trying to have a pretty, go back to have one of the big, exciting, double-sized issue 25s like Marvel and DC used to do when I was a kid, where, you know, issue 25, issue 50, 75, 100, they all meant something. Seems these days issue 25 comes along, eh, it's just another issue, you know, nothing special, nothing built up to it. So I wanted to do with the Phantom where everything built up to number 25, and then after 25, I'll build up to 50. But this introduces a new villain. I won't tell you who he is because, you know, I don't want to spoil anything. But he makes his first appearance in issue 12, and you get to see a little bit more of him in issue 13. Beyond that, issue 14 and 15 fill in a gap between two of Lee Falk's stories that ran in the newspaper a long time ago. The first one, I believe, came out in the 40s, and the second story came out in the 50s. But in the timeline of the fashion, they happen in about a six-month time span. So issues 14 and 15 will fill the gap of what the Phantom was doing in that time span. Issue 16 will be, the artwork will be done by Eric J. down here, and we have a pretty neat cover done by Brett Blevins, which I don't know that Joe brought a copy of.
Yep.
And that'll be a standalone issue, and then issues 17, 18, and 19 are going to be a three-issue arc that will touch on a lot of things that are currently going on in Africa in current events. I think towards the end of Mr. Falk's life, he wanted to really instill a lot of current events into the Phantom stories. He had the Phantom fighting terrorists and all sorts of things, and there's some pretty nasty things going on in Africa right now that I feel if the Phantom was a live person and he was over there, he wouldn't stand for it. He would try and do something about it. So 17, 18, and 19 is going to address that. And then issue 20 and so forth will pick up the stuff from Tiger's Blood and really roll it right into issue 25.
Cool, thanks, Mike. Raph, you want to give just a quick little rundown here on what Maneaters is all about? Yes, we can all hope that.
In a world where brother kills brother, in a world where the cost of land is worth more than the cost of life, one intrepid federal agent and an immortal stand between the greed of man and the wrath of an ancient god.
Thank you. Thank you.
Kit Walker is the ghost who walks in the Phantom Maneaters.
Well, that was much more brief than your story, yes.
Let's all go to the lobby.
All right, well.
These are the two covers to the Phantom Annual coming up. It was probably, I don't know if, I think Joe's actually got a wig on because he went bald dealing with the logistics of putting this book together. Yeah. Between Raph and I, Ron Mars, Tony Bedard, Chuck Dixon, we were all kind of playing to our own drummer and so forth and doing our own thing, and Joe was trying to hold it all back together. So give Joe a round of applause for not losing his sanity while dealing with all this. The story takes place over five centuries. It has five different phantoms. Starts off with the very first phantom and works its way all the way to the newest one. Each one of us writers has got a different chapter. And basically it's the phantom fighting the Singh Brotherhood, going after an ancient object that the Singh Brotherhood has been trying to get since late 16th century. So, and that will be out, like Joe said, around Christmas time. Mm-hmm. So we're only 6 months behind schedule, but that's what happens when you deal with, 10 crazy creators.
Okay. We'd certainly like to open up to any questions. Anybody has any comments or questions?
Yes.
Take some notes, Mike.
It's not a bad idea. I actually have a few stories that I'm working on plots for that involve past phantoms. I believe it was the 10th phantom who was a very good swordsman, and I love swordplay, so I've been toying with some ideas with that. Some of the stuff that gets set up in the annual is also going to lead into other things. The Sing Brotherhood returns in a big way in the ongoing series, and the new leader of the Sing Brotherhood will make his first appearance in the annual. So there, the Sing Brotherhood is definitely alive and well, and Ben brought the Sky Band back, so they're still alive and well. A lot of the old, you know, Lee Falk villains are still there. So
we have the, with the prose books, we also have the advantage of being able to do any Phantom from any time, from any point of view. So we will have a lot of that in those prose anthologies as well.
When was the Sky Band featured?
Was it issue 7 and 8?
Yeah. I asked that if someone who has the original Sunday page or another Sky Band from the little theater report.
Which page?
It was the one where the Solomon's Lieutenant is making out with Phantom and the cell, both Solomon and
see, is it amazing how complicated those plots were? Such jeopardy to think about himself.
I think they got this number 8 after 9/7 but 7 sold out.
That is correct. Oh, and remember that the Moonstone booth has been listed incorrectly in the program. It is booth number 2042. So we were out there by right under the butt of Pikachu, I believe, the big inflatable Pikachu out there.
And the con personnel have been personally thrashed for making a mistake.
Yes, I left a skull mark on a couple of them. So.
Excellent. Well done, sir.
That'll learn.
Anybody else? Any questions, comments? Songs? Sing-alongs?
Any questions from the lovely representative of CDG?
Oh.
I didn't quite hear your question, actually.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
The question is how difficult it is to avoid going camp with the character.
To me, it's really easy because he's not a campy character. It's just, you know, the movie was cool for a movie, but it, you know, it had a lot of Hollywood influence to it that didn't necessarily speak of what Lee Falk was doing. If you're really familiar with all the newspaper tales, the movie plot actually was kind of a bastardized 4 or 5 different Lee Falk stories kind of all jammed into one, and then they threw in the campy villain. And he, you know, it was a neat movie, but I think Treat Williams' character just gave it that campy vibe to it that you know, that I don't think was ever present in Lee Falk's stories.
No, you really can't have a bad guy who has a high-pitched voice. It doesn't work.
No. And I mean, if he came up to you and actually tried to threaten you in a dark alley, you'd probably laugh at the guy. You know, versus, you know, you see, you know, Timur Singh or Kabai Singh or one of the Sky Band or somebody, they're actually villainous and they're scary characters. It's not, you know, this guy that, you know, makes all these silly off-color jokes and I don't know.
I think one of the problems is as soon as you adapt any superhero for live action, people get very concerned about the idea of the spandex suits, and that's why films like X-Men just blow that off and go with, you know, leather outfits and whatnot. And so as soon as you try and remain faithful to a character who's wearing a purple costume, it's very, very easy for Hollywood producers to just sort of make fun of that a little bit. So.
Well, I think in today's day and age, it's really a lot easier to go gritty and forget the humor altogether. And I think the hardest part about it, and I think what Ben did so good in his run, and I haven't seen Mike's yet, but I'm sure he's got it in his mind, is keeping the humor that has been a part of the Phantom for 70 years, a part of the Phantom, and yet still have it be edgy and gritty. How do you do that and not make it campy? And I think that's what, like I said, Ben did so well, and what I'm looking forward to Mike do so well. So that's a good question. But
the whole thing is that, like, when the Phantom is the sense of humor of the book. The situations he finds himself in aren't funny. It's just the way he sort of approaches it. It's his way. It's his, you know, sarcastic allows him to sort of deal with these really dark, you know, scenarios and these evil human beings. It's not always funny, but you do try to find those moments of levity because, you know, you don't want to be beaten over the head with serious, dark all the time. And he just lends himself to that because, you know, even though he may be outnumbered, he's still got the edge. And he's got that in the back of his mind at all times.
and it's what's in his heart, you know. The Phantom is not a dark guy, per se. He finds himself, like Ben said, in dark situations. A dark guy isn't going to go into a dark situation and make jokes, but a guy who's more lighthearted and good-hearted like the Phantom is, will.
Which, in a lot of ways, you know, you could, if you want to get really psychological about him, it's a defense mechanism. It's, you know, I'm a guy with a gun, which I used to actually shoot somebody, and a knife, and that's it. All I have about me are my wits. And if I don't keep my wits about me, I'm dead. And if I die, my kids, you know, one of my kids has to now step into these shoes. And that's, you know, again, it's all like subconscious back of his head stuff. This is when you're writing it, you think about these things when you put him in these scenarios.
Cool. Okay.
Right,
here's
your thinking.
I have a question as a former fan of color, I don't know about the DC fan. I think notice that the DC web pages are also often misunderstood, that they seem to be shifting the fandom's options to a more grayed down and leave off, of course, a free play. He created the character, and the character called the Gray Ghost.
That's correct.
Went through a big dilemma about that myself because I was doing a photorealistic Phantom and I was concerned about it looking a little too candy colored, and I brought it down a little bit, but then I also wanted to be faithful to the at least the Sundays. Regular shows were black and white, but I wanted to. So it's a tough balancing act between the iconic graphic image of the purple suit and also the reality of, well, a guy in his situation, if he did exist, probably wouldn't wear something that bright.
Through most of the years, you know, Batman, also used to tell the Batman.
Right.
You know, Batman was like purple costume, like Hawkman flames. And then
yellow and
gray.
Right.
You know, became gray, which was what it was supposed to be all along, and then he was just printing technology kind of caught up.
Well, that's printing technology is exactly the reason why the Phantom wound up being purple, because back in the day it was a four-color process, and here's a character who's going to be in a green environment most of the time, blue skies. So, there's a few primaries of color, then there's no primary, you have red, and then you have to start getting the secondary colors. And for the printing process and for the pop, purple was, I think, a very good choice for the situation, for the dynamics of the storyline, to put him in purple, to pop him against the green jungles, against blue skies, against brown trees, trunks, whatever like that.
But even at 10% or 20% yellow color, for example,
just needed slightly. Well, I'm not sure about this, but I recall that the old color processes didn't have that. You'd be lucky to get a 25%. It would either, basically, it was quarters. It's either, you know, 100% this, 50% this. Very few times would, you know, they go down to 25%. Below that.
Yeah, this is one of those things, though, that kind of goes into the licensor, what they want us to do, what they told us we can do, what we can't do.
Yeah, that was one of the first questions I asked Joe, is can I do a Gray Phantom?
Right, and we thought that would be cool. Yeah. But
I thought it would be a great image to do, but he said, no, King Features won't let us.
Yeah, that can't be done. As far as muting it down, if they're doing it, you know, it's certainly something we can ask him about, but so far the edict is to have him remain purple.
Right, before the Singer got his hands on the Superman franchise, I saw some production designs that were going to put Superman in, not in a blue and red primary colored suit. And I said, okay, it may look more realistic, but that's not what everybody's used to.
Karen, you had a question?
What kind of continuity did King Features ask them to maintain?
I'm so glad you asked that question. No, I'm just kidding.
From a writing standpoint,
Features didn't give us any kind of guidelines as far as that is concerned, continuity, because as you know, it's the Phantom is published all over the world. Originals and reprints in no order whatsoever, and it would be a logistical nightmare to try to follow some of that continuity. So we were able to kind of create our own continuity, and that's provided a lot of freedom for us up here. Otherwise, you wouldn't see any of these one-shots or these annuals. We'd still be working on all of that stuff, trying to coordinate with Sweden and Norway. So we're on our own.
I'll tell you, I've done work for those guys too, and they've got their own way of approaching it. It's not, there's nothing uniform about this whatsoever. There's like maybe four or five guidelines that any license has to sort of, you know, adhere to with regards to the fan's behavior, the things he says, the kind of language you can use. Beyond that, it's like, you know, figure it out. Good luck. Don't make a mess.
Yeah, I wasn't given any instruction as to how thick his belt should be or how big the triangle on his belt should be. I mean, those were decisions I made myself. And a lot of it
should be seen.
A lot of it was just like my own love for the character and wanting to remain faithful to the classic version, but then trying to find, you know, how it would function in real life, so to speak. So it's. And at no point did Joe say, "Oh no, that's, you know, his gun is too big or his belt is too thick." Or,
a late addition here. Welcome, Ruben. Ruben did the very cool black and white annual cover.
Thanks. It's great to be here. I'm actually really impressed. We have actually something going on the Phantom here. I'm a big fan.
Cool. There was a question over here in the back. Go ahead.
I want to thank you for not bringing angst into the Phantom and keeping him a clear set of what is good and what is evil.
Well. Oh, well, I really appreciate it. I think we all really appreciate it.
To me, that was the selling point on writing the Phantom, because he wasn't some angst-ridden anti-hero, you know? God, there's a million of them out there, and he was the first superhero, so that's what he should be. He's true blue. You know? Well, true purple.
True purple.
Sorry.
You know, we get to have all that angst and gray toning of characters with all the supporting cast, everybody around him, but the Phantom, he's the white hat hero, and that's the way he's going to be.
Well, what's interesting about him is he's not a tragic hero or anything. You know, if you look at Superman or Batman, you can play with the sort of tragic elements of their background, but he's just kind of the way he is, because it's a fun addition, basically.
That was one of the reasons I had so much fun drawing it too, is because, like you said, he's the hero's hero. He's very. I don't think there's such thing as a pure hero anymore in most literature or movies or anything. He's very much the. As a matter of fact, what was one of the most fun parts that I had on my issues was Chuck had written a scene between the female protagonist in that particular scene, couple of books, and the Phantom, and she turns to him and says, you know, she's kind of trying to come on to him, because, you know, he's a good-looking guy in a purple bodysuit, you know? and she says, "So is there a Mrs. Phantom?" And he goes, "Yep. Ask me any question you want, I'll tell you." And that to me, not that he's not mysterious and everything, but the fact that he's not going to lie, you know? He's like, "Okay, yeah, I got a wife. You don't need to know what her name is or where to find her, but yes, I do." You know.
Was there a question here?
Why do you think the Phantom is not popular here in the U.S. as it seems to be around the world?
That's a good question. Anybody want to feel that?
I think a lot of it is, you look at all the superheroes that are really popular, you know, Spider-Man, Superman, you can walk into a store and there's Superman underwear and Batman party hats, and King Features never seemed to do that, and I don't think Lee Falk was really interested in doing that with the character. And I think in the United States, that's the kind of thing that it takes to ingrain things into our mindset of, you know, if the kids these days, they see Yu-Gi-Oh! Everywhere. You know, you can't walk into a store that's, you know, like a Walmart or a Target or something without seeing Yu-Gi-Oh! All over the place. And that's why the kids are so into it, because it's ingrained into them. It's part of their life. Over in, what is it, Norway, the Phantom helped him get through World War II, so he's a, you know.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite stories, man.
Yeah, he's a legend in that country. He helped that country survive World War II, and that's part of their pop culture heritage now.
I think another big reason is he's not an American, and we're very ethnocentric about you know, things being American. I mean, Superman, I mean, even on this year's T-shirt, Superman is depicted standing in front of the American flag, and also the jungle setting. We've become an urban culture. And a lot of the popular characters, kids can identify because they walk down the same streets as Batman swings across or Spider-Man swings across. So I think that also has something to do with it.
But you also have the comics came from pulps, but like Ben and I were just thought, you know, kind of low talking. As soon as you brought superpowers into the costume heroes, it became something other than high adventure. You know, it's not... The Phantom is still very much a pulp character. You know, he's high-adventure swashbuckling, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas, like, Batman, even though he doesn't have any superpowers, you could argue that he's so rich he has a superpower, you know what I mean? And so on and so forth. And these guys are going up against, you know, villains that are very identifiable. Where you could say that the Phantom also has very identifiable villains in, like, the Skyman and so on, but there's not the one guy that the Phantom goes up against that everybody here knows.
Yeah, until Mike gets on the book, right, Mike?
Yeah.
Oh, there was Andy. Man in the hat here.
My relationship with the Phantom goes back 30, 50 years. So it starts with the comic strips and goes on from there. I think one of the things about the Phantom and its popularity in the United States is the popularity of newspapers has dropped off.
That's very true.
Considerably. So you don't see the daily Phantom script that I used to take up to my father. So what do you call it?
Yeah.
But as far as the Phantom goes, the character of the Phantom to me has always been the hero raised to be. He's been the guy that knew all along his entire life. Eventually, his father is retired and died. He has to step out of the race. He has to take over. That, I think, is what the driving force between this character has always been.
You know, that's exactly what we were trying to address in Legacy, because it is. It's, you know, think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I, you know, 2 years ago I became a father and I have a daughter, and I'm not going to ask you to become the Phantom, but, you know, there are certain things you expect that, you know, anyone who has kids knows, you expect them to sort of step into certain shoes of yours, the ones that you left unaccomplished or whatever. Here's a guy who's saying, because of the experiences of my life, the unpredictable, unfathomable experiences that I've gone through, I'm asking you to take it upon yourself to risk your life for the benefit of others. Ultimate and selfless sacrifice. And that's, there's no other hero that does it. No. At least certainly not to this extent, 500 years. So, it's a pretty compelling thing. Right. Slacker Phantom.
There's a question way in the back. Sir?
Yes, can you tell me what this King Features actually is? What, do they prove all your stories? Have they ever rejected anything you've tried? What exactly is the interaction between yourself and the actual holder of the copyright?
King Features, on one hand, is a lot like dealing with the Pentagon. They are a very big corporation that is part of the Hearst Publishing Group. The Phantom is a very, very small part of what they do there. We have a story editor. We have an art editor. We have a legal counsel over there. One of the funniest story we like to tell is very early on. Boy, I wish I could, it was Ben's story. We had the Phantom basically commandeering a Jeep and driving it in a big hurry because, you know, Diana was in trouble. Well, we were told that the Phantom does not drive recklessly. We had to change that. You know, and of course, the guns are always a big problem. Here's a guy, he's got two guns. He's obviously a very good shot. He carries a knife, but he really can't hurt or kill anyone. So in order to make that work, I mean, how is that still a threat? How is that still protection if he can't do any of those things? And, you know, so they look at every story and every piece of art that goes by. As time has gone on here, they're easing up a little on us, but they're pretty strict on what they want the Phantom to do. And that driving thing, that's out, man.
Once they look the other way, once they're comfortable with us, look out.
Yeah, it'll be Phantom Reckless NASCAR.
Driving everywhere.
Phantom NASCAR, yeah.
Phantom NASCAR. Purple number 21. Tell the Phantom NASCAR driver he can't get in a wreck because the Phantom doesn't wreck.
Oh, yes, that's correct. Exactly. He does not drive recklessly. All right, cool. Well, hey, thank you very much for coming out. If you guys, on your way out, we have free bookmarks and posters for everyone.
If anybody wants a sketch, they can come by the booth, and I'll be there.
2042 for the booth number.